And a little bit later tonight, you'll have your chance with questions and stories as we talk about near-death experiences and we talk about the incredible power of the brain with the spiritual doorway in the brain with Dr. Kevin Nelson on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Dr. Kevin Nelson. Kevin, it seems to me that as science gets involved in this, that it takes away from the spiritual aspect of it in terms of, you know, is there, you know, intelligent design behind this? Is there something truly metaphysical here? Am I reading that right or not?
Well, I don't think so, George. I think it doesn't hurt to know a little bit about the mystery. It doesn't hurt the mystery itself, actually. And I think that why the brain is doing this and the meaning that it gives us will always be beyond the province of science. And, for example, let me give you
I want to go back to that ESP story as well, but go ahead.
Evolution changed our ideas of how we got here, but it didn't change why we're here. And so it didn't remove the spirituality of human beings. It simply help give us a little different perspective on it.
Okay, now let's go back to the ESP episode where you had this feeling that, you know, your father was there and he was shouting your name, and then in reality, you go and see this, and it's happening.
Yeah, actually, I had the vision at the time that I was coming to from the faint,
yeah,
that he was there. And it was a vision that was clear, but it wasn't as vivid as if I were actually seeing it. And so I became very addled and rushed home about a block away. And sure enough, my father was there at the door, quite angry at me, because as it turns out, we had had a family outing that was planned, and I was holding everybody up. So this in fact, my father was quite disturbed with me. I had no idea for a long time, in fact, of why that vision occurred to me. You know, but I felt I had connected with something that was certainly inexplicable and beyond me.
Beyond the brain?
Well, I think that it was beyond what I understood about the brain at the time. But now I think I see it in a little different light. When we're in crisis, and remember when I said that when the brain is not getting enough blood flow,
mm-hmm,
like with faint, the brain sees that as a crisis, memories come to us. And you know, your life can flash before your eyes. I mean, if you're falling off a cliff, and there have been studies that have shown this, that, you know, during falls, people will have be flooded with memories. And this has a real value evolutionarily, but we activate our memories. But if our brain is not functioning quite right because its blood flow is less than optimal, these memories may come to us in unfamiliar ways. And I suspect what happened was that I was activating the memory that I was to be somewhere else, and I think that that's what triggered the vision that I had, and that turned out to be true because my memory had turned out to be true. But that memory came to me during my faint. Now, I have no way of knowing that the vision I had at the time of my faint was actually corresponded to what my father was doing at that particular moment. There's no way for me to verify.
No, there is
that.
No way.
Yeah, and therein lies the rub. That's where we have great difficulty. So in many ways, this is beyond science. I mean, I can't study it in a scientific way, but, you know, I can formulate an explanation in scientific terms.
Let's talk a little bit about God, if we can.
Mm-hmm.
Is God out there, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, I do think that there are forces that are directing human destiny, that beyond our poor powers to appreciate or control, of course. I think that, and again, the issue of God and the question of God is something that is really beyond science to address. And I think that, and I want to make this point very strongly, that is what I find most annoying about the staunch atheists, is because they actually are extremists in saying that science can disprove God. Well, science can't do that. They don't understand the true nature of science. So, and there's always, well, and there will always be room in the brain for faith. Now, I also believe that there are scientific reasons to believe there are going to be many different forms of consciousness, of which we are one. And so I think that there's a great unseen universe out there, and for us to think arrogantly that we understand it and that it fits within the narrow scope of what we can know in science is something that is arrogant and an idea that I don't hold.
Well, doesn't that thought, though, of just that doubt tell you that it's not just all about the brain?
No, I don't. I think that what we can know is about the brain. I think there are things beyond our brain, but we can't know them right now.
Well, here's my point. Let's assume there is an afterlife.
Okay.
Well, just assume that there is. Whatever it is, another dimension, whatever, there's something else out there that is beyond the physical realm. When we die, and I'm going to ask you this as a neurologist, the brain dies, right?
Yes.
It doesn't still function.
Right.
So, you know, it's all gone. So if there is an afterlife, and the brain is gone, it's dead, then that would tell me, I would conclude, that the afterlife can exist beyond the physical realm.
Yes, but that is a question that is beyond science.
I agree.
Yeah, and so, and George, what I'm very careful to do is confine, you know, my inquiry into this in scientific terms and lead the face of the afterlife in the face of questions beyond the brain. And they're in many ways the more important questions. And I leave that to other discussions and other venues.
So you're not counting it out, though, that it doesn't exist?
No, I'm not telling you it doesn't exist by any means. Certainly I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's not something that I can study when I'm studying the brain.
Does this or has this changed your own beliefs?
You know, that's a really good question. And the answer to that is an emphatic no. I will never forget one of my vivid memories is that after the book was released, I gave a talk at the church that I attend. And our church is affiliated with the university, and we have many physicians and scholars, and one of them in the audience is a cancer specialist who I've known very, very well for almost 25 years and knew her father very well. He was an important figure in my professional life. And after speaking for a while, she raised her hand, and she's a very kind and sensitive person, and she says, you're writing and researching this book change your faith in any way? And I said, no, it hadn't. It hadn't changed my faith or what I believe in beyond the brain, because I am totally focused on how the brain is participating in spiritual experience. Why and the meaning of that is something that cannot be addressed by science, and so I really don't address it in the book. I'm really focused on the spiritual doorway in the brain.
If the brain allows us to do incredible things like being intuitive or being psychic or having telepathy, Can we alter the brain to make this a regular function of our day-to-day living?
Well, if the brain basis of this, yes, if we understood the brain basis of this, but it's very difficult to fully understand what within our brains gives us these abilities. Now, we know that there's certain regions of the brain that when stimulated either with an electrode or by seizure activity will give a very deep impression of deja vu. And in fact, this can be a common accompaniment of a certain type of seizure. So we know there's some areas of the brain that can give us, that when stimulated will give us very unusual experiences.
Give me another one of your case study stories, Kevin.
Well, I'll tell you, one of them, the most remarkable, was a woman named Jan. And I think that I was left with such an intense awe of her courage that I really felt compelled to bring it to people.
She's the one who was shot, right?
She was shot accidentally, and she immediately went into shock and was airlifted to a medical center, and the surgeons worked frantically to save her. And the bullet had gone into her abdomen and then lacerated internal organs and went up into her chest cavity. And so while she was in shock, they gave her anesthetics. They opened her abdomen up, and they were exploring her bowels and with their hands, and they were concerned because her blood pressure was so low that there was a collection that was strangulating her heart, and so they opened her chest up.
Oh, geez.
And they started massaging her heart, and through all of this, she was awake. She was alert.
Did she feel this?
Yes.
Oh.
Horrific pain and terror. And
I've heard of these nightmares, but this one takes the cake.
They're rare. In fact, I had three of my near-death subjects who had their experience while they were supposed to be so asleep, but were not.
But you can't move. So they're cutting your chest open. You can feel it. You hear the saw. But you can't move.
You can't move. You're paralyzed. You're paralyzed. For her, it could have been they gave her paralytic medications, and in fact they did. I had the opportunity to review her medical records. But also, because of the shock, you're so weak, you are actually paralyzed for that reason as well. Well, she, as they were massaging her heart, she had a warm glow of peace and calm came to her, and her mother came to her and said, "This is not your time, and you will make it through this." And then she mercifully lost consciousness. When she recovered, she, of course, was incredibly moved by this experience. And as I was,
oh sure,
hearing it, and it really had changed her life, of course, and for the better. That was perhaps one of the most dramatic of the experiences that I've recounted. But you know, in the book, I really go through a whole variety of different kinds of spiritual experiences. You know, I discuss someone. You know, drug-induced experiences where a young man who later became a physician experienced absolute power, the absolute power of God, while playing pinball and watching the ball hit the bumpers and the flippers, you know, in perfect synchrony to the Who's song "Won't Get Fooled Again." Another one of my neurological colleagues who had a terrifying mystical experience while walking on the beach, and the tie-in for many of these Georges, actually one that's been has really been overlooked. And a sizable number of people will have that during near-death experience. But this calls in a little different part of the brain than the REM system. And it's a very, very moving experience. And it has a deep connection with fear. This circuitry that helps produce mystical experiences is overlaps with the circuitry that we use to have the experience of fear. I mean, I think most people are aware of, quote, the, quote, bad trip. And even when hallucinogens like psilocybin are given in controlled laboratory conditions, very, very safe, people have an experience of fear because we're activating the fear and the mystical circuitry simultaneously because they're intertwined with one another.
What have you concluded about your 30 years of research?
That there's a lot we don't know.
and that you knew that coming in.
I knew it coming in, and I'm going to know it going out. I really think that we're really on the cusp, George, of understanding a great deal about how the brain works in spiritual experience. And it works in ways that we really couldn't have dreamed of, you know, 20 to 30 years ago. I mean, for example, in the split brain experiment that I think some people are familiar with, where the brain, the right and the left hemispheres are severed, from their connections are severed. And so you really have two sets of consciousness in many ways independent within the same skull. And we find that the left side of the brain is our explainer. It is the part of the brain that wants and demands explanations and will create them even when where none would otherwise exist. And that's an important part of spiritual experience. And I think that that's partly what distinguishes us from animals, because in my book, I allude to how...
You do look at animals in your book.
Yes, and I think it's clear that because much of our primitive brain participates, our primitive brain is the responsible for much of our spiritual experiences, that means that other species could potentially have spiritual experiences. But the missing ingredient is that left hemisphere, you know, that interprets an experience as spiritual. That part's very important.
We're talking with Dr. Kevin Nelson. His book is The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. What's your website, Kevin?
The spiritualdoorwayinthebrain.org.
Simple enough.
And I must say, I really welcome people sharing their experiences with me, and I really hold them in great respect and high regard.
Colleagues and peers, what do they say about your work?
Well, they say very fine things. And at first, I went in this with a little trepidation because neurologists have really looked askance in many ways at subjective experiences, certainly those that are powerful as and have such great meaning as spiritual experiences. But really, the ideas in this book have been endorsed by several leading scientists and writers, including Oliver Sacks and Ramachandran and international sleep experts.
Well, you've got some heavy hitters there. Kevin, we're going to come right back for more on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial. Well, we're going to take your phone calls and also your stories of near-death experiences with Dr. Kevin Nelson, and we'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Kevin Nelson with us. Kevin, is your research finished or are you still ongoing?
Oh, it's still ongoing. I'm really looking at some of the mechanisms that will evoke near-death experiences. George, one of the surprising things that we found in our research, and I go into on the book, is that fainting is a very common cause of near-death experience.
Fainting. Explain.
As I said earlier, when the brain doesn't get enough blood flow, even for seconds, that triggers these fight or flight and survival reflexes in the brain. And that is what forms the basis of many of the near-death experience. Now, the brain, if the heart stops, or if you have a simple faint, to the brain doesn't know the difference. All it sees is that the blood
it's
is
not
flowing.
There. Yeah.
And so it reacts in a very similar way. In fact, some people have found already back in the 90s that fainting will, by itself, safely in the laboratory, will reproduce many of the facets of near-death experience. But in addition to that, there was an article published by Dr. Owens in the 1990s in Lancet, and he examined the medical records of almost 60 persons who had had a near-death experience, and only half of them actually were medically in danger. The other half were not medically endangered. So these experiences, although we usually think of them commonly as coming on with cardiac arrest, and certainly that does bring them on. These experiences can also be brought on by triggers that are not nearly as dangerous.
As you look at the work you did, the spiritual doorway in the brain, is there one question that you would like answered, Kevin, for yourself that you find perplexing?
Yes. I would like to look more closely at that connection between the mystical sense of oneness and the near-death experience. I think that, you know, we got hints that there is a connection there. About 42% of our subjects had some sense of unity, but I think that that's an important relationship that really needs further explanation, and in part because, although near-death experience, I believe, is the dominant spiritual experience of our time in modern history, throughout all of human history, that mystical sense of oneness is really what carries through and really influenced human history.
How many people who have experienced near-death experiences come back a little more spiritual?
Well, I have not done that work, but my intuition and in our 55 subjects, I would say almost everybody is affected. It's hard not to be affected. Now, not everybody is. Some people will. In fact, in the book, I cite some people who are, though shaken by the experience, you remain atheists or remain unconvinced of an afterlife. So certainly not everybody comes away with the same impression. But by far and away, the vast majority of the people see this as a profoundly positive and influential experience. And we mentioned earlier about my sister-in-law Lila and her father and how important the comfort was that knowing that the passage to the other world would not be horrific. She also said to me, she said, you know, Kevin, I don't really care what the brain's doing during your death experience. I really, you know, they really just care about the experience itself, and that's a wisdom in that.
Sure.
There's a real wisdom in that.
Karen, where does evil Kevin come in with any of this?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that in our near-death experiences, and what's really clear after hearing many of these accounts, is that in these brief but very powerful experiences, we bring other elements of our life in as well. And, you know, our memories will come in. And so if we have evil touching us, you know, in other aspects of our life, I can see where it would also gain entry into these experiences as well.
All right, let's take some calls here. Let's pick it up by going to Mark, truck driving in Ohio, first-time caller. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, great to talk to you.
You too, Mark.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
Great.
My question is from is from a personal experience. I want to know what your opinion is as far as you believe in a, like, I guess some would call it a soul. I don't know that that would be my definition. But just an inner self that is actually, running things, that actually has control over, the brain, the body, and
all right. Let's call it the soul. Do you believe in a soul, Kevin?
Yeah, Mark, I think that's a really important question. As I said earlier, and I really want to reiterate, whether you see we have a soul that's directing these experiences or not is really a matter of faith. And the faith that you bring in to these experiences and understanding the brain's role will be the same faith or lack of faith that you have at the end. I really want to make it clear whether I believe there's a soul or not, whether George believes there's a soul or not, or whether you believe there's a soul or not. When it comes to the brain is really for me where it's all at, and I really like to focus on that. And that's really what the book is about. So if you believe that we have a soul that's guiding our inner self, that consciousness is maintained after the brain, there's nothing in the book that would say that that's not true.
We'll go to George in New York. Hey, George, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, George and Dr. Kevin Nelson.
Hi.
About a year ago, I was expedited by my doctor because he accidentally discovered that I had an aortic aneurysm. And Richard Holbrooke, the ambassador to the Middle East, had dropped dead, a couple months before from it because it hadn't been diagnosed. Anyway, so I got expedited in, and I was in the hospital about 10 days, and they did the operation. But the crazy thing was, first of all, I think faith is a gift, and science and reasons and so on, I think, complements it. But in the ICU, after the operation, when I woke up, I was a terror, a demon. I mean, I tore my, I ripped the bandages off my arms that were keeping me down on this cot. I pulled all of the tubes and stuff out of my neck. I'm standing there in the dressing gown, dripping blood, and the nurses and stuff, and I said, call the police. Where am I? Get the security here. Get me out of here. Pure survival, right? Anyway, somehow they quieted me down, sedated me, whatever. Okay, 3 or 4 days later, now I get transferred from one room to another. Totally forgot. In fact, that never happened as far as I knew. Okay, now I'm still in the hospital. And now I'm getting ready, and they're getting ready for the other part of the hospital where you go, before you get discharged. And I go in there, and it was in the evening, and there was another guy, in the back of the room, and there was a curtain between us. Anyway, and it was in the evening. So I'm lying down, and he starts ranting and raving in his sleep. And it was everything that I had said. I mean, it triggered the memory of my being in the ICU and get me out of here and this and that. It was incredible. And what I realized is that I had my subconscious had incredible survival instincts, but also a powerful denial that this had ever happened. And I started crying and praying just in my bed there, and all night long. And it reminded me of the agony of Christ in the garden when he emptied himself of his human, of his God nature, and was just a human being, and he knew what was coming, and he shed blood. And the connection to me was absolutely like lightning. And I it's a year later that I'm home now, and I think of it every single day.
George, you raise a really very important point about memory, and that is we can have experiences that we forget that remain in our subconscious until they're triggered by a very frightening or threatening event, like what your roommate was going through as well. And then it can all come to us in a flash. Being able to activate our memories in times of crisis is really very, very important for our survival instinct. I mean, if, for example, when our ancestors were in the Serengeti Plains and they heard a lion's roar, it's a good idea for them to suddenly remember how they got out of it last time so they can get out of it this time. So I think that you tell a very nice example of how powerful memories can be contained within us and then brought out in times of crisis.
So you would not say to someone, oh, come on, it's just a figment of your mind or your imagination?
No, not in this instance at all. I think that when we're, particularly in the ICU, memories are laid down in very unusual ways, because we're not normally in an ICU and our brain's not normally sedated or impaired. But that doesn't, we may have trouble retrieving them at the moment, but there can be very important triggers like crisis that will bring these memories out.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Randy, welcome to Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, this show is amazing. It actually brings up a thought that's been in the back of my mind. It's a little bit along, but I have to get it out for you guys.
Sure.
I'll just go right into it. We all have heard that we're made in God's image, that God created us with the word of God. Our heart, it has beats. And just now, as science is finding in string theory, they're finding that atoms are made of tiny strings which vibrate. Vibration, of course, as we know, is music, like radio, sound waves, we have good vibrations. Now, the guest said something about light and the REM state. And like the Freemasons say, all light is knowledge. Well, here's the knowledge. This is what came to me, and I don't know, maybe you can do something with it. Seven. The number seven is a divine number. We have seven musical notes in a major scale. Our bodies have seven chakras to balance our health, and seven colors in the rainbow. I don't know if you can do anything with that, but it came to me one night, and there you have it.
All right. I don't know what we can do with it, but it's good to know that it's there.
Well, Randy, I think that this reminds me of something that tells us of how little we really understand, and that is there's a passage in the Bible, 1 John 1:5, that says, God is light, and in him no darkness at all. What's intriguing about that is, in fact, that most of the universe we now know through science is dark energy and dark matter, what if spiritual truth were, in fact, lay within dark energy and dark matter, since we know very little about these substances? We might know scientifically very little about spiritual essence.
This spiritual doorway to the brain, if the brain gets hurt or damaged, does that affect this?
Well, I think oftentimes during brain injuries, in fact, when we have some of our most profound spiritual experiences, car accidents, for example, a mild concussion, or when the brain isn't getting sufficient blood flow, or getting just an interrupted blood flow, not getting this optimal amount of blood flow. These are oftentimes the triggers for spiritual experience.
Let's go next to Valdosta, Georgia. Chris is with us, first-time caller. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
How you doing? First-time caller, long-time listener.
Good to have you with us.
Being in the military, I've had my fair share of fear-based scenarios and everything, myself and friends, coworkers alike. Now, also being in the military, we receive a lot of training so we can better cope with those scenarios. Now, what's consistent with a lot of that stuff is when we recollect those fear-based scenarios and stuff we've been in, a lot of us have kind of an out-of-body memory, like kind of an over-shoulder view of what was occurring at the time, not a first-person view. Secondly, through that training, I think a lot of us automatically go to that training we receive so we can react. Now, some don't. When they're in that scenario, though, recollect a family member coming to them and saying, hey, you can get through this, you can get through this. So my question is that a normal response to kind of have that outer body view of what happened in that time frame? And two, does that maybe explain some of these visits from family members when people have near-death experiences because they don't have that training and their memory is just automatically like a Rolodex going through the closest possible way for them to cope?
Both good questions.
Situation.
Well, Chris, you've hit on some very important points here, you know, and I think it's our response to danger is really what you're describing very nicely. And in fact, that sort of distancing yourself from events, sometimes people will say, you know, it's like happening to someone else, it's like a movie, you're kind of stepping back. That does come through training. In fact, I personally have gotten it through my martial arts training, but also it happened to me when I was shot at and chased, as I talk about in the book, In the Spiritual Doorway, and that kind of reaction of distancing yourself. Now, I said earlier, in times of crisis, our memory system is activated, and some of those memories that are activated may come in the form of our loved ones giving us good advice, and I think that's quite natural to have happen. There's actually another, not completely related, but another military type of experience that people have reported with true out-of-body experiences, and that's with fighter pilots. They actually, during their maneuvers, may have true out-of-body experiences and see themselves from above their jet flying the plane.
Let's talk more about that, Kevin, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.